This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast, and my name is Kieran Pedley. Well, we're almost there after what feels like the longest Labour leadership contest in the history of man. On Saturday, we find out who the next leader of the Labour Party is going to be. And it looks very much like that person is going to be Jeremy Corbyn, although some people think that Yvette Cooper may mount a late surge to victory, but we remain to be convinced about that. On this week's podcast, I spoke to former Ed Miliband spokesman, James Stewart, who I happen to know very well. We go back way back, and we had a bit of a chat about his experiences on the campaign trail, why he thought Labour lost in May and what Ed Miliband maybe could have done better. And then we talked a bit about the Labour leadership contest and what might happen next if, as we assume, Jeremy Corbyn becomes the next Labour leader. I started off asking James a little bit about what he did for a job, and then we moved on to the general election campaign itself. I guess let's start with a little bit about your role within the Labour Party and working with Ed Miliband. You're obviously a spokesman for Ed Miliband, but I guess although people have this idea of what being a spin doctor, being a press officer, you know, being in the leader's office might involve, perhaps people don't really understand what the day-to-day of that might mean. So maybe just briefly give the listeners a bit of an overview as to your role within Ed's office and the types of things you'd be doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the bulk of the role is basically managing the political news agenda, and that has several different elements to it. So obviously, when there's a negative story that is going to be published or has been published about the Labour Party, you do your best to minimise the damage of the story. And there's various ways of doing that. But you also try and take advantage of mistakes the government makes. So if there's a sort of negative story about the government, you will do your best to sustain that story, and by putting up spokespeople to talk about it, by releasing quotes, you try and sort of enhance interest in the story to obviously damage the government's reputation.
And presumably, being in the media world, actually you get quite advanced sight of what's actually going to happen in the next couple of days in the press before it even does.
So sometimes. You do, yeah. I mean, usually journalists will
call you and say, "We've got this idea, yeah. We've got this story. What do you reckon?"
Yeah, if a journalist, for example, is going to write a negative story about one particular political party, they will call some rep at the press office or a spokesperson from that political party in advance to front them up about it, to check the story's right, if they want to dispute the story, given the opportunity to or also the opportunity to explain what's going on in the story, really. I think one of the most interesting things about what I used to do was people who listen to this probably watch Prime Minister's Question Time quite often. But after Prime Minister's Question Time, all the journalists herd out of the gallery in the House of Commons to this side room, where there's a debate. You have the government spin doctor somewhere, you have the opposition spin doctor somewhere, you have the Liberal Democrat spin doctors elsewhere. I assume now you have the SNP spin doctors there as well, all sort of giving their take on PMQs. So if your guys had a good day at PMQs, then it's relatively easy, and you sort of look at the government and think, think I don't envy your position today, but you know that in a couple of weeks' time the
is that
the
quite similar to the leaders' debates when you had people, you know, politicians standing there with giving,
it's very similar, very similar to the spin rooms, but there's no cameras that capture the magic of it, so it's a kind of it's definitely a version of that, but it happens every week, and I think it's how it really affects how PMQs is perceived by the sort of world outside, because it's obviously these journalists that are reporting on it and reporting on the political news that stems from it.
So obviously as a sort of press officer or spokesman or whatever, you know, like spokesman's official title, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Presumably there must have been days when there must have been some bad days in there, and times when you really had a sort of crisis to manage, which goes with the territory, I guess, in politics. I mean, were there any particular events during the last Parliament that were quite challenging for not just yourself but Ed's office to react to? Because obviously it seems to me, in politics, you've got to react quickly to things, otherwise the story can develop a life of its own and then you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, there were. I mean, gosh, what the situation around the selection in Falkirk, which led to the changes in the way the leadership is elected, was obviously a challenging situation because of the way the story developed, and that was challenging. Other areas that were challenging. I mean, the general election campaign, the sheer intensity of it, the fact that you operate on a sort of outside the general election campaign, you operate in a very busy environment, but in the general election campaign, the intensity is just so significant that the level of media scrutiny, the amount of events you have to put on, the intensity is just sort of very, very, very significant.
Yeah, but let's talk about the general election campaign. Obviously, there's a lot's been written and lots been said about why Labour lost the general election, but also about the polling, of course. Mm-hmm. And this podcast is obviously very interested in that. I mean, before we go on to why Labour lost, I mean, what was your private thoughts during the general election? I mean, did you think Labour were on course to win in some fashion? I mean, maybe a majority was unlikely at that time, but presumably you were seeing the public polls or whatever went on privately as well, and reading into that. I mean, did you think that you were going to win?
I think, like most people, I thought that there'd probably be some form of hung parliament, and thought that within that we had every chance of sort of coming out on top.
I mean, because Ed did, the conventional wisdom was Ed did much better in the leadership debates than people maybe expected.
Yeah, I think he also did well in the general election campaign in general. I think I remember reading somewhere that a large chunk of the Tory strategy was just to wait for Ed to make a mistake. And while there were things that you can question in the leadership campaign, there was no fundamental mistake made, I don't think, from that caused the whole series of days of coverage about the mistake. Mm. There were some things you...
Well, he didn't punch anybody or refer to anybody as a bigot, did he?
No eggs were involved.
Probably a sign of his experience. So let's move on to why Labour lost. Obviously, there's been a lot written about this, lots of different opinions out there. It's become a major issue in the Labour leadership contest itself, which we'll come on to shortly. I guess there are lots of different views, but perhaps they can be paraphrased or categorised into two broad areas. One is the kind of New Labour or moderate analysis, which is that Labour wasn't credible on the economy. Maybe people didn't see Ed Miliband as a sort of credible Prime Minister, and therefore that Labour needs to get back to this kind of Blair/Brown approach of being able, or maybe more Blair, of being able to appeal to Middle England. And on the complete flip side of that, there is the idea that Labour, over a longer period of time, has lost its soul. It's not the same party that it used to be, and I guess the inference there is supposed to be. And more specifically than that, some people on the sort of Corbyn left are accusing Ed Miliband of being Tory light, running an austerity light campaign that wasn't sufficiently different to the Conservatives. And I guess the accusation there is either that, you know, people were so off put by this austerity light agenda that they voted for the Conservatives anyway, which seems a bit bizarre, or to give them their due, the people that advanced this notion, that Labour weren't that different to the Tories anyway, therefore why should we care if they win? What's your take on this idea of why Labour lost, but also this idea of Miliband being kind of austerity light?
And frankly, the idea that Ed Miliband is Tory light is just ridiculous. He opposes the Tories like passionately with every ounce of his body, and I'd also dispute the fact we went into the election with a sort of austerity light package. We had a different policy on reducing the deficit. We had policies like the mansion tax. We had a different policy on income tax rates. Now, I mean, those are all things that the 97 and onwards Labour parties didn't do, and I think that we can get on. You asked also about the problems with why we lost. I think one of the problems with why we lost is that there was a major banking crisis that led to the biggest recession in a long time since the war, and people who don't pay that much attention to politics did pay attention to the fact that that happened. They also bought into the Tory analysis of that, which is that Labour crashed the car and don't give the keys back to the guy who crashed the car.
So was Labour strong enough in refuting that? Because it seems to be that, that a criticism you could level at Miliband and Balls was that if that was wrong, and the Labour Party's position is presumably that they did not crash the car, why were they so unsuccessful at convincing the public that they were right?
Well, so, I mean, I guess from the more right side of the Labour Party, their view would be that we should have taken more steps to apologise for the economy and take the flak for...
Because specifically there's this moment in one of the leadership debates where a member of the public asks Ed if the last Labour government spent too much money. Mm-hmm. And he says no. And that's not only Ed Miliband in the Labour Party that thinks that, and I'm not necessarily passing judgment on whether that's right or wrong, but many look at that as a moment where they thought, Labour just hasn't learned, and almost regardless of who's crashed the car, we can't trust Labour on the economy. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment of one of the reasons why we lost the election, really. I think that when you consider the sort of normal voter who doesn't really care much about politics, but when they're given the chance every 5 years, they'll think, well, hang on, do I really think that the Labour Party has changed enough to not repeat the mistakes that were
that comes back to the whole blame thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
The repeat the mistakes thing is, well, they crashed the economy in the first place. And again, I go back to the central point. I suppose Labour was as unable in the last Parliament to convince the public that it wasn't responsible.
I think that's true. I mean, I think the fact is that the Labour Party lost the blame game for the economic crash in the last decade, in 2008. And I think that while you can and should make an argument for the successes of the Labour government from 1997 to 2010, there remains in the public's mind an anxiety about Labour and an anxiety about our how responsible we are with the economy. And I think that rather than the small steps that we did take to try and achieve that in the last Parliament, I think you need to take big steps and demonstrate in a big way that you are responsible with the finances.
So what's that? Is that just saying, about committing to a policy? Is that about saying, okay, in the next Parliament we're going to balance the books? I mean, is it about bold statements like this, or is it about, individual commitments to, addressing specific public spending issues that you might not think Labour are going to address, such as wages in the public sector at the top end or something like that? Because presumably it comes back to spending, and this the age-old problem with the Labour brand when it's at its weakest is that it just spends too much money. When it's at its strongest, it's about investment and fairness and helping people get on and, taking on the big bad Tories. But when it's at its weakness, it's about spending too much, isn't it? And that feels like where Labour is at the moment. Or is that unfair?
I think that's certainly where the brand is at the moment. I think it's partly also about just consistency, because I think the public out there are very attuned to when they, particularly with politicians, to when they hear someone who is inconsistent in terms of what they're saying. And I think that one of the challenges that we didn't really overcome was that you had us saying we will balance the books, but also being seen to list a whole series of spending commitments that were paid for. I think people would have thought, well, come on, like the priority at the moment is balancing,
tightening
the belt rather than.
So we talked
an example would be rather than cutting tuition fees.
So we talked about the economy, obviously. I think most people would accept that's generally a central plank to how people choose who to vote for. But there was other issues too, weren't there? One we haven't discussed yet is Scotland.
Yeah.
And I suppose this comes to the heart of the debate about the future of Labour as well, because obviously Labour was wiped out in Scotland. It was used to be a sort of heartland where Labour had 40-plus seats. Now there's one. And I guess this comes back to the argument about why Labour lost, but also about the future too, doesn't it? Because if Labour's going to get back into power, presumably it needs to reverse the tide there in Scotland. But for every seat it's unable to win back, it needs to compensate a bit for that in England, presumably, unless it's doing a deal with the SNP. So I just want to get your views on Scotland and where Labour might go from here.
Well, I think just to go back to a previous question, I think Scotland played a very important part in the general election campaign, actually, because you had this situation where the narrative of a large chunk of the election campaign was basically the fact that there will be a Labour government propped up by the SNP. Now, that caused us huge problems because it was the story was sustained purely by David Cameron saying it will be a disaster when Nicola Sturgeon backs up the Labour Party in government. And then Nicola Sturgeon the next day would say, I'm definitely going to make sure that when there's a Labour government, I will introduce loads of really left-wing policies, which
doesn't help the economic argument, does it?
It doesn't help the economic argument, but it also causes this. It caused this sort of whirlwind during the election campaign where we were the key participant in a story that was sustained by two different parties, like arguably who were. They would never admit this, but working together to ensure that happened because it met both of their objectives, the Tories winning seats in England by scaring English voters and the Nats by convincing Scottish voters that what they would deliver is a Labour government backed up with a very strong pro-Scotland SNP.
Because you were in Scotland for the referendum, presumably, because obviously Ed Miliband was up there from time to time. What was your sort of feeling when you were up there in Scotland? I don't know how often you visited there in the past, but presumably the referendum campaign was a very different country.
Well, the referendum was amazing in lots of respects. The level of political engagement was huge, but I think what led to the referendum, and then what led to the campaign, and what led to what's happened afterwards was, and is over a long time, a build up of an agenda within Scotland about sort of Scottish nationalism being the principal driving force there. And that has...
So what does that mean? That means that the priority for the political parties in Scotland is to get a better deal for Scotland.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so... And when that sort of sets the terms of the political debate, you can't get much better than Scotland should be on its own and looking after its own affairs. And that has led to... That's led to a political debate that is very focused on what's good specifically for Scotland rather than what's good specifically for the rest of the UK.
Was Labour unable to answer that question? Because I mean, looking back, I mean, the last Labour government had a Scottish Prime Minister and a Scottish Chancellor, and therefore you'd assume that people in Scotland would look to Labour as the natural sort of party to defend Scotland's interests. Or do you think there's something going on with Scottish Labour over a longer period?
I think there is something that's going on with Scottish Labour. I mean, you have to remember that it was a shock when, in 2006 or 2007, the SNP government was first elected. That was like, this is like, no one expected the SNP government, everyone expected as soon as devolution happened for it to be Labour run for the whole time. And I think Tony Blair said recently that there was a lack of, when devolution happened, a lack of developing a culture across the UK and across the devolved parts of the UK that bound Britain together. And I think that, I think basically we're caught up in the cycle of political institutions and other institutions being set up specifically for Scotland, which sort of sustains and increases the level of identification with Scotland among the entire population, as opposed to the rest being part of the whole of the UK.
So we've talked about the economy and we've talked about Scotland, obviously, not just the impact of Labour losing seats there, but obviously the psychological impact that would have on English voters as well, which is maybe underestimated by some. But this comes back to Ed's leadership, doesn't it, to a large extent. The economic argument, you know, is ultimately the leader's job to over the course of a parliament to convince the public that both that leader and the party are credible on the economy? And is not the prospect of Nicola Sturgeon making Ed Miliband dance to her tune, is that not also a reflection on just how up to it the British people or the people in England particularly thought Ed would be as a prime minister? So I guess if it is about the economy and if it is about Scotland, presumably the public not necessarily seeing Ed as a credible prime minister is a large part of why Labour lost too. Is that fair?
I think that was clearly an aspect of how the election turned out. But I mean, if you look at the course of the general election campaign, I think Ed, more than any other time during his leadership, demonstrated that he was prime ministerial. And I think broadly speaking, that did penetrate down to the public to some degree.
The truth is, though, on a strictly horse race basis of him or David Cameron, people always saw David Cameron as the more credible prime minister. Do you just put that down to the fact that he was the prime minister then?
Well, I think there's a degree to it. If you ask people a question, who is the more credible prime minister, they understand that one of those people is the prime minister. They say that person because they are the prime minister. It helps with being credible to be doing the job that you're talking about being credible to do. But I think there was clearly a problem with how Ed was perceived as a potential prime minister. You would ideally want his perception numbers to be a lot higher than they were. I think that his relationship with his brother was something that certainly did capture the public imagination and influence how people saw him.
In what way?
Well, I think people just recognised the or were made aware of by the media and others of the fact that he stood against his brother and the major kind of controversy that stemmed from that.
I guess David was better known in the public's eye, probably.
I don't really think it was that. I think David would have had a reverse version of this had he won, because I think it's about the fact that two brothers stood against each other. And I think that certainly caught the public imagination, and it certainly influenced how people saw him.
Well, I mean, whether rightly or wrongly, and presumably you would say wrongly, I mean, even polls now, regardless of Ed Miliband, will still make David Miliband a very kind of, in inverted commas, popular amongst the public candidate for Labour leader even now. So,
but I'm not sure that's really can be that accurate, because, I mean, what do the public... Like, just from a sort of research perspective, more than anything, what do the public see of David Miliband that they can use to form that judgment?
Well, they just have this vague notion of him being the right brother that was the former foreign secretary, and then versus these others that maybe they don't really know as well. But anyway, we were talking about Ed Miliband as prime minister. So, I mean, was there anything you think he could have done more, or do you think his image was just defined by the time we got to the election campaign, or do you think his image was defined quite early by the Sun
I think his image was defined very early. I mean, I think his image was defined from the first couple of years of leadership. And
presumably that's a lesson for whoever takes over, is that they've got to define their image.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that partly because Ed's campaign was a sort of outsider's campaign. Partly because of that, I think that... Whereas David Miliband's campaign was more measuring the curtains of the leader's office, I think that partly influenced how prepared Ed's campaign team were to become and take over the leadership. I think whoever wins the leadership election this time needs to be very prepared that the Conservatives and sections of the media will look to characterise that leader in such a way that it's very difficult for them to escape that characterisation.
So let's move on to the leadership contest. Obviously, we've talked about why Labour may have lost. What's your assessment of it? Because it seems to be, it's quite remarkable, really, that we started this process with Jeremy Corbyn being essentially added to the ballot almost out of pity, or maybe more cynically, because certain candidates thought that they could beat him heavily. The left would have had its moment. they're dealt with, and we move on to Andy Burnham or Yvette Cooper as leader. Whereas now, it seems that the conventional wisdom is that Jeremy Corbyn is going to be the leader of the Labour Party. I mean, first of all, do you think that's likely? I mean, the YouGov poll that has been talked about on this podcast in depth was a little while ago. I mean, and if there was a, you know, the counter-argument to Corbyn's inevitability, I guess, would be that if there was an election that was destined for late swing and sort of vulnerable to a shy non-Corbyn sort of surge or presence, it's this one, isn't it? So, I mean, where do you see the state of the leadership contest? Is Corbyn inevitable?
Well, it's clearly not inevitable. We'll find out on Saturday what the result is. But I think that everybody I've spoken to and the impression I get is that it will be very, very surprising if Jeremy Corbyn's not the next leader of the Labour Party.
So what do you attribute his rise to? Because, like I say, this is not someone that feels like they've been coveting the leadership for very long. In fact, that, you know, as I wrote today on this blog, it almost strikes me that it was his turn from that sort of section of the PLP to stand as a candidate. And yet, you know, he's managed to, looks like he might win. So what do you think that's down to? Is that down to him finding his voice?
I think a number of factors, really. I mean, I think that you have to recognise that that his campaign team have run quite a slick campaign. They've also, more so than previous, it's never been the case previously that the left-wing candidate got sort of big union backing. The most left-wing candidate got big union backing. And Jeremy Corbyn's done that this time. I think that they've certainly also understood the way that the Labour leadership rules have changed and taken advantage of them. Having said that, several people I've spoken to think that sort of even if you were working on one member, one vote with the Labour Party membership as it was on May the 7th, 2015, you'd still get Jeremy Corbyn winning.
That feels like quite a damning indictment of some of the other candidates who, particularly Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper, are quite experienced front bench politicians. I mean, Liz Kendall obviously has been around to a lesser extent. Do you think that, I mean, is it just that there's three kind of non-Corbyn candidates and he's able to push a very clear message and they're sort of fighting amongst themselves for the same kind of territory? Or do you think they've just his opponents have just completely misjudged the mood of the membership?
I think there's a number of factors that go into it. What I would say is I think Yvette Cooper's done a good job of challenging Jeremy Corbyn and challenging some of his sort of positions.
Quite late.
But was the first of the three others who took that on. And decided that it was sort of necessary to take on the Corbyn challenge. But in terms of the general campaign, I think one thing that has influenced it was the different candidates' reaction to the welfare vote, which was quite a prominent point, I think, during the election campaign. And particularly Andy Burnham struggled to argue about why he abstained on a vote but still opposed the policy.
Because it's a very nuanced parliamentary kind of collective responsibility thing, which
exactly.
Isn't necessarily illegitimate, but it's just when you're trying to cut through to people.
Exactly, and I think that welfare is always a very emotive issue within the Labour movement, and I think that was probably, I think, one of the key points in galvanising people around Jeremy Corbyn, who was seen to offer a bit more clarity. I mean, you also have to understand that the Labour Party membership has changed quite significantly over the past several years, particularly with the recruiting of registered supporters. I think a lot of them have come from what would be defined as sort of the left or far left, and so I think those factors came together to sort of change the way the leadership election has been run compared to previous ones. And
the way it would go.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let's assume Jeremy Corbyn does win. Is it Saturday the results announced?
Saturday.
Yeah, it's Saturday. I mean, let's assume he does win. There's been a lot of speculation as to then what happens next, I guess for the very good reason that no one really saw this coming for a long time. Some MPs have talked of coups. Some MPs have talked of varying degrees of French resistance, either inside or outside the tents of the shadow the shadow cabinet. You've obviously been someone that's dealt with the PLP a fair bit in your role as Ed Miliband's spokesman. From what you know and from your experiences, Where do you see it going after Jeremy Corbyn's elected leader? Obviously, he has to sort of pick his shadow cabinet. But, I mean, what do you think the PLP's next step is? Because ultimately, let's not forget, this wasn't necessarily someone they wanted as leader.
Well, I think that's quite an important point because 90% of the PLP don't want Jeremy Corbyn as leader, or at least were fairly resistant to the idea, would have been fairly resistant to the idea a couple of months ago. We'll see how this pans out, but I would imagine that Jeremy Corbyn's first proper encounter with the electorate, which will happen in May 2016 when there's elections in Scottish Parliament elections, Welsh Assembly elections and local government elections across the UK, so a big set of elections. My view is that Jeremy Corbyn will alienate far more voters than he persuades the Labour case. For a number of reasons, but just take a couple of examples. It's very easy to characterise Jeremy Corbyn in a way that the 1980s Labour parties were characterised around security. There was a 1987 Tory poster which had Labour's arms policy and then a picture of a soldier with his hands up in the air. And I think that the Tories, you're already seeing the Tories talk about security a lot. And I think the Tories will put a Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn under a huge amount of pressure from security perspectives, citing his friendship with various Middle Eastern terrorist organisations, citing his friendship with the IRA in the 1980s and 90s. So I think that you will have that Labour Party encountering the electorate for the first time, and I think it will be a bit of a bloodbath, to be honest. And I suspect that the ordinary members of the PLP will use that as an opportunity to challenge his leadership. I mean, if you look at the fundamental challenge of the last general election, which is that we didn't put across to the British public that we were as economically responsible as they wanted us to be. If we react to that by electing Jeremy Corbyn as a leader, who not only goes further from a lot further from where Ed and Ed were in terms of economic management to the left, but also in terms of basic issues of security and things like terrorism, he's just off at the wacky races. I mean, they're not gonna buy it, the British people. And
let's assume there comes a challenge at some point, but presumably the people that challenge him have got to be extremely careful. Unless you think Jeremy Corbyn is going to be the Labour leadership sort of candidate in the 2020 general election, you're assuming there's either going to be a contest because he's stood down, or there's going to be a contest because people have tried to oppose him. He's still going to either be that candidate, or the left are going to put up their own candidate, aren't they? So, I mean, how do you see the kind of future dynamics of the Labour Party playing
well,
out in that regard?
Well, I think the Labour Party needs to set aside a lot of its own, I would say, relatively artificial internal divisions. So you've got lots of different groupings in the Labour Party, people that see themselves as Blairite, people that see themselves as sort of old right, people that see themselves as soft left, people that see themselves as any old thing. I think this will be a wake-up call to the broad moderate group of Labour MPs that they need to work together rather than oppose each other. And I think that it's only through the PLP working together in a sort of unified way within the broader moderate group of the PLP that will happen.
And the comparison I often make is, and you know, you may disagree on this, is it feels quite like the Tories when they chose Ian Duncan Smith as their leader. Now, there are differences here. Ian Duncan Smith didn't necessarily have a sort of outside sort of union movement organising for him or lots of money behind him. And so on. But ultimately, there was a leader who the public deemed as unelectable, and that person was removed, and the Conservative Party decided not to consult the members again and just gave them a candidate, which was Michael Howard. I mean, do you think that's likely? I mean, although, because it does feel like, you know, either Jeremy Corbyn himself getting 35 MPs or someone of his ilk getting 35 MPs feels quite likely.
I think the Tory party's internal democracy, it means it's a lot easier to just present the Conservative Party members with a leader than the Labour Party. What I do think is you could get a more unifying figure being from the moderate wing of the Labour Party, that and one figure rather than several figures, and I think that could have an impact on how the leadership on having a different leader. But I think I agree with you though, it's pretty inconceivable for there not to be a left wing candidate.
Presumably there could be a left wing candidate who is strongly anti austerity and maybe, you know, on economic issues, some people might not consider them to be as credible as they ought to be. But if they don't have some of this other baggage that Jeremy Corbyn has, maybe they can do well. What I'm saying is maybe the left does have a future, and maybe the Labour Party will fight the 2020 general election from the left.
Well, I hope it doesn't. I really hope it doesn't, because I think that it will learn a lesson it's learned several times in its history, which is that you need, if you're the Labour Party, you need to be seen as being responsible with public money and the broader economy.
I mean, is there anyone, thinking about the sort of Michael Howard approach or just a unifying figure within Labour, and I don't want to put you on the spot with saying it's going to be this person, but are there any candidates that you see in the PLP that you think could perform that role? Because presumably the fundamental fact is that Liz Kendall or someone like that is not going to lead the Labour Party. Even Chukwuemunna feels like he may struggle by being associated with that wing. It feels to me, and you're closer to the PLP than I am, so correct me if I'm wrong, it feels to me that ultimately the next Labour leader that the PLP and the party can get behind is probably going to be somewhere in the middle, arguably not far away from where Ed Miliband was, but perhaps someone that the public sees as more credible as PM.
Well, I think one thing that's worth remembering is that Tony Blair didn't fight his leadership election from the right of the Labour Party. He fought it as a sort of centrist within the Labour Party, and got support from lots of different quarters. So I don't think it necessarily means the Labour Party is going to cease to be able to accommodate that kind of leader. But I think the leader needs to recognise that the priority in the leadership election is to win the leadership election, and then go forward from there. There are several Labour MPs that come to mind. I don't think I will do them the disservice of saying their names publicly now, but they can be a secret between myself and my bookmaker. But I think that the Labour Party will really struggle if it goes into the next general election fighting from a sort of radical left position, and I think that the PLP are the sort of group that hopefully will stop that from happening.
I mean, you say Labour can't win an election from the far left, and I suppose it would be very hard to disagree with that, because far left, far right presumably is on the margins of politics and therefore unlikely to command majority support. But I guess one thing we've kind of left out of the future of the Labour Party is Scotland, which we talked about earlier. Labour used to have 40-odd seats there, and now it's got one, and presumably it can't win again without winning some seats back in Scotland. And the conventional wisdom is that, you know, to do that, it needs to be in Scotland, it needs to be further to the left.
Well, I think the key thing to understanding Scotland is understanding that it's a nationalist government. It's not a left or a right-wing government. there's plenty of things that that Alex Salmond has said and done that point to him not being very left wing at all, actually. So I think it's much more of a nationalist political agenda than it is a left wing political agenda, in my view. I think personally that, in a way, Britain, this is bigger than the Labour Party, really. Britain needs to take Scotland at its word. It's voted for a much more inflated version of devolution. I think we should be saying now that Scotland needs full fiscal autonomy, and I think it will enable them to have a proper debate in Scotland about what matters to people in Scotland, rather than a debate where
Westminster versus
Scotland. And I think that's the situation in Scotland is a nationalist situation. It's not a left or a right wing situation, and so I think they are the next steps. And I think the Labour Party, frankly, should be advocating full fiscal autonomy for Scotland.
And finally, I suppose that there's going to be maybe Jeremy Corbyn, maybe somebody else. There's going to be a new leader of the Labour Party quite soon. Based on your sort of experiences working with Ed Miliband in that office, I mean, what do you think are the things they've got to do quite quickly in the next sort of month to 2 months to be able to establish themselves?
I think that they need to. Well,
there's obviously a conference speech.
It's quite a busy month, frankly. They've got.
So you've got conference speech. You've got shadow cabinet. You've got then introducing yourself to the public, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest challenge I think that whoever wins has is to try to define themselves rather than let themselves be defined by external factors. I think if it's Jeremy Corbyn, that's a very difficult thing to do because I think he's done so much and said so much in his career that defines him so easily and obviously. And I mean, frankly, I think it's hard not to sort of be worried by some of those positions if you're a member of the public. And but if it's another one of the candidates, I think they need to move quickly to define their to define themselves.
James Stewart, thanks very much.
So that was the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. So a big thanks to my guest, James Stewart, there. Lots of interesting topics discussed, hopefully. Hopefully you agree. Now, we only have a few days left until we know who the next leader of the Labour Party is. And those people that read my article a couple of days ago on this very blog will know what I think about this. Broadly, not that far away from what James thinks, that although Yvette Cooper has her faults, of the four candidates there, she's the one that I see as being the most likely to win an election, even if you accept, and I think it's fair to say, that 2020 is a very difficult election for Labour to win regardless. But there is a counter-argument to this, of course, and it would be unfair not to put it across. You know, Jeremy Corbyn has very clearly captured the mood of the Labour Party in a way that is unprecedented for a candidate that's such an outsider, as I think it's fair to characterise him as. You know, there is clearly a desire amongst the Labour membership to present a sort of platform for government of the country that is distinctly different to the Conservatives, and I guess we can argue about what the policy implications of that might be, but the members clearly have that desire for change and for something different. And I suppose if Jeremy Corbyn does win, the key challenge is going to be to define what that change for Labour means and to define it as a good thing rather than a negative thing. And I think, as we know, there are plenty of sort of controversies in Jeremy Corbyn's past on matters of defence or the economy or people he sort of hangs about with that will come back to haunt him. And I suppose the question is going to be, how well do he and his team deal with that? That said, they've obviously done a very good job of running this leadership campaign. So it will be very interesting to see how they handle the first sort of month to 6 weeks if he is successful, and we will find out soon enough. Of course, people on the left think that this is a good thing if he wins and that he'll be able to inspire non-voters and people of the left that maybe voted Green or the SNP or others to all unite behind the Labour Party, and this will be a new way of beating the Conservatives. I'm sceptical. I've made that very clear, but you know, it might not be long until we get to find out, because if you believe the bookmakers and the pollsters and many of the pundits, Jeremy Corbyn is going to be the next leader of the Labour Party, and we don't have long to wait to find out what that's going to mean. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons, and you'll be pleased to know that in the coming weeks there'll be more episodes of Polling Matters that won't necessarily talk about Labour, because I know that the last couple of episodes have been very much dedicated to Labour, given the leadership contest. We'll be looking at the EU referendum, the Conservatives, UKIP, and the Liberal Democrats too. So stay tuned for more episodes, and thanks for listening.